Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who?
His name is Rob.
His name is Rob.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. This is episode 3, and I'm your host, Rob Irwin. And I've got to say, I'm super excited to say that this will be our first episode where we'll have more than just myself talking for the whole episode. Later in the show, we'll have Kate, who some of you might know as Kamadu on Twitter, talking about one of the Doctor Who BBC audio stories, Pest Control, which is narrated by the 10th Doctor himself, David Tennant. And we'll also have Lex, better known as Lexiness on Twitter, talking about last week's Doctor Who episode, Listen. But we'll come to both in more detail later. I just wanted to mention it up front, as I'm so excited to get our first contributors onto the show and out into your ears. If you'd like to contribute to the show, particularly from a Star Wars viewpoint, I'll have some more details on that later. Now, how's your week been? Mine rocketed by crazy fast. I blinked and it was Thursday, you know, that kind of thing. In terms of the show these past 7 days, as I said on Twitter a few days back, I'm really quite gobsmacked at the kind of daily hits we're getting on the show. Really good figures, actually, for something brand new and just a bit quirky, you know, being a bit Star Wars and a bit Doctor Who. I mean, let's break it down here. I'm fully aware in making this show that no matter how successful we end up being at delivering an entertaining and interesting show each week, and no matter how many people tune in, we're never going to end up on StarWars.com's list of Star Wars pods because of the Doctor Who side of things. Or on the flip side, singled out as an authoritative place to go for Doctor Who fans because we spend half of it talking about a completely different IP each week. So to see so many people downloading it, I guess does prove my theory correct that even though we might not make it onto StarWars.com or end up top of mind in every Whovian's thoughts, I'm definitely not alone out there in being passionate about both these IPs, and there are plenty of you out there who are tuning in to hear both. Now, speaking of Doctor Who, I had an interesting discussion with Patrick Troughton earlier in the week. Now, there's something you don't hear very often these days. No, it wasn't that Patrick Troughton, folks. There's a chap on Twitter with the handle @bestDoctorWho, and he uses the name Patrick Troughton, and I was chatting with him. And the topic was a recent piece on the metro.co.uk website by writer James Baldock, talking about one of the recent Doctor Who episodes, Listen. Baldock's piece said in part, quote, "Ultimately, this whole story came across as a territory marking exercise by Moffat, who seems determined to rewrite, or at least consolidate, as much of the mythology surrounding the Doctor as possible. Hence the Time Lord's destiny is shaped by Clara in the middle of a barn, just as it was in the repairs department when she urged him to take the TARDIS with the dodgy navigation because you'll have more fun. I wouldn't mind if these little brushes with history actually added anything to who the Doctor was, but they don't. It doesn't feel like the sort of character exploration proposed by Andrew Cartmore back in the 1980s, or even the flashbacks to a Gallifreyan childhood that formed the Master's backstory in The Sound of Drums. It feels like showing off." End quote. I commented to Patrick, "What a whiny review. It can't see the wood for the trees." Patrick said to me that he disagreed, and he said, "It's the most honest review I've read so far." And my response to him was, "I think it will appeal to a certain demographic, i.e. those who want to nitpick and demonize Moffat for basically anything." And I think it might be fun to continue down that line of thought in general, as this ties back in a related way to the mini-editorial I did on showrunner Stephen Moffat last week. See, one of the criticisms I saw being made on social media last week, which wasn't a personal attack, and thus okay in my book, was this line about Moffat territory marking in Doctor Who. And here are my thoughts on that. I think it's the right of every showrunner to put their mark on the show. I think if a showrunner wants to zip back to when the Doctor was a boy and show him being afraid of something to tie into the current Doctor, that's just good storytelling. There's a lot we don't know about the Doctor's past, and still don't know, so dipping into it like this, in a rather minor way, didn't seem like territory marking to me. It simply felt like telling an interesting story in a place we haven't been before. To me, people seem to pull out this territory marking line if they don't like Moffat. Perhaps Russell T. Davies could have taken us back to that barn and shown the Doctor as a boy hidden in shadow, and everyone would have thought it was great. So, what's different? Well, there's obviously this thing with Moffat now that no matter what he does, some people are going to try and view it from the worst possible angle. And that annoys me quite a bit. Like I said at the start of episode 2, I'm no Moffat apologist. If he writes a stinker this series, you'll hear about it here first. Probably quite literally, as we publish the show very soon after the UK transmission of Doctor Who, but I digress. Similar complaints get thrown at Moffat for spreading Clara all through the Doctor's time streams in earlier episodes. Again, you can call it territory marking, or you can just see it as a way to bring back all the other Doctors in an episode, in its 50th year, in one of the cleverest ways how, given, you know, three of them are dead, and the rest, bar McGann, look nothing like their former selves. That's how I saw it anyway. It was a way to get all those Doctors in, whereas the territory marking folks see it as Moffat making his companion get to interact with all the other Doctors. Now, did people throw this complaint at John Nathan Turner in the classic era when his companions, Tegan and Turlough, got to interact with other Doctors in the Five Doctors? Nah, of course they didn't. To me, this is the kind of complaint that only exists because people want to have a go at Moffat, not because it's an actual, genuinely valid complaint. If it was, I'd be truly happy to entertain it. But it's not. Anyway, moving on. In a random Star Wars encounter this week, I saw Star Wars Rebels EP Greg Wiseman talking about the 50th anniversary of the Ford Falcon model in the US. That's a car, for those of you who don't know. I dived into the conversation and started talking about the Ford Falcon models we've had here in Australia, which, since the 1970s, broke away from the US models, which weren't continuing anyway at that time, and have become a staple on the roads here in Australia. Greg was quite interested in this, and actually, we had some comments back and forth, and I gotta say, I found this really bizarre, but it was fun, you know. I wasn't hassling him about Star Wars Rebels, even though that's probably what a Star Wars podcast should have been doing. You know, I'm just really happy to see Greg is still out there and involved with Rebels. As recently as September 19th, I saw on Twitter he was also talking to Amy Ratcliffe. She's a writer for Star Wars Insider magazine, and she was talking about a piece she's written with him in it, and he was commenting on that. And the reason I'm going in this direction is a little while ago, around the time of Comic-Con, there were stories swirling around, such as one on the Big Shiny Robot blog, and at least one of the other big Star Wars podcasts that I listen to as well each week, that Greg wasn't on any of the Rebels panels at Comic-Con. But he was in San Diego at the same time, and when someone asked him on Twitter why he wasn't on any of the panels at Comic-Con, he simply replied, "Don't know," which was a really strange, almost cagey sort of answer. Now, there are still stories he's not involved with the second season of the show, which no one's commenting on one way or the other at the moment, and I suppose with the show yet to debut, no one wants to announce that one of the EPs is heading off into the sunset after this first season. If he is doing that is, we still don't know. Keep an eye on that story. Once this first season of Rebels gets going, we might learn a little bit more about whether Greg is coming back or not. Either way, I'm still going to talk to him about the Ford Falcon on Twitter. Now, before we get to my top stories of the week, I've also got some listener feedback to share this episode, and given that the first of the two is about my mini-editorial on Stephen Moffat, and I just was speaking about Stephen Moffat a moment ago, perhaps it's well-timed. Sarah McCutcheon, a good friend of the show, has written in via Twitter about my little editorial on Stephen last week, and the smashing that he's getting on social media, where sadly, some people just don't confine themselves to saying they don't like an episode or a character, something, you know, which is fine to have an opinion on, but whom attack Moffat personally, playing the man and not the ball, basically, which is not cool, not clever, not smart. Indeed, in any other scenario, say it was happening to those Twitter users in real life, they'd be calling foul and calling it bullying. And Sarah said to me, "Gotta say, you really hit the nail on the head in your latest podcast about those who bully in Who fandom. Nice work." I replied back and said, "Thanks, Sarah. It just needed to be said. Those who need to hear it the most probably won't hear it, though." And to that, Sarah replied, "I've known some that have also been bullied for liking Moffat as well." And I mean, wow, what can you say to that? People, be kind to each other out there. If you've got a beef with an episode or character, that's fine, that's great, that's your right. But if someone else likes that character or episode, don't have a go at them. If they like Stephen Moffat, you know, they're not some sort of lesser being that, you know, are just there for you to kick. Personally, if I see anyone being pointlessly negative to others on my Twitter feed, for example, I'll either mute them or, if they're totally nuts, just drop them altogether. And I don't want to do that. I want to hear from fans of Doctor who have all sorts of opinions, and this goes for Star Wars too. But if you can't have an alternative idea to someone without personally attacking another fan or the person making the show about stuff that has nothing to do with the show, personal stuff, then I can't stay listening to you. It's just not right. Anyway, our second piece of feedback this week comes in the form of an MP3, and it's from Kate, also known as Kamadu on Twitter, who we mentioned earlier, and who'll also be contributing a review to the show later on. She says, well, I won't tell you, I'll just hit play here on the message.
Hey Rob, Kate here. Love the show. I wanted to write in about Star Wars Episode 7 predictions, so here goes. I think we'll have a title before the end of the year, because as fans, we've earned it. I think we'll see the teaser trailer before the Cinderella movie that's coming out in March of 2015, because that just makes sense for Disney. And then I think we'll see a full trailer at Celebration Anaheim in April of 2015, because what better audience could you possibly premiere that to? What do you think?
Okay, thanks, Kate. Wow, what do I think? Well, I guess the first thing to say is anything is possible. And particularly with Disney now in charge, when you see how long and hard the media blitz for Star Wars Rebels has been, and when you consider that Rebels is just a blip on the radar compared to the marketing that will get thrown at Episode 7, you know, Disney might go long and loud on this and market the heck out of Star Wars Episode 7 in a similar way to what you've just proposed. Or might they stick a bit closer to what they did with the prequels? Well, not Disney themselves, but what Lucas did with the prequels. I did a little research on this. Now, Episode 1, which came out in May of 1999, the name of that movie was released September 25th, 1998. And the teaser trailer was released with Meet Joe Black on November 13 of 1998, although other sources put it with Bug's Life around November 17th, 1998. And then a second trailer was released on March 12th of 1999 with the film Wing Commander. So there the name came out about 8 months before opening, the teaser was out about 6 months before opening, and the longer trailer was about 2 months out. Now, with Episode 2, which came out in May also of 2002, the name was announced August 8, 2001, teaser trailer premiered with Monsters, Inc. November 2nd, 2001, and a longer trailer, was aired on the Fox network between, remember these shows, Malcolm in the Middle and The X-Files on March 10th, 2002. It was also made available on the official Star Wars website the same day. So for Episode 2, the name was announced 9 months before opening. And again, the teaser was about 6 months out and the longer trailer about 2 months out. Now, I hope this isn't getting boring, but we're almost there. Episode 3 also came out in May in 2005. The name for that film was released the 24th of July 2004 with a teaser trailer attached to the Pixar film The Incredibles, November 5th, 2004, and a longer trailer on March 10th, 2005 during an episode of The OC. There's another show a lot of people might remember that's not around anymore. And it also popped up around the same time in theatres as well. So for Episode 3, the name was announced 10 months before opening. You can see in each of these movies it's getting, you know, longer and longer when the name was announced. But again, about 6 months for the teaser trailer and about 2 months out for the longer trailer. So that tended to say stay the same. So with this information, building an alternate timeline to what Kate suggested, we could assume that the name of Episode 7 might come out between February and April next year. That's an 8 to 10 month spread before release, and that fits in with what we saw with the prequels. And Kate, as you say in your MP3, Celebration Anaheim is in April. So maybe Celebration will be when they release the name of the film. Also, based on the data gathered there, the first Star Wars Episode 7 trailer would likely be released 6 months out before the film's December 18th, 2015 release date. That would give us a target date for May, maybe June of next year. Now, I had a quick look at what films are coming out in May and June, and in May, the options are, to my mind at least, Disney's Avengers: Age of Ultron or Disney's Tomorrowland. June options, meanwhile, are Universal's Jurassic World and Pixar's Inside Out. Remember, these trailers don't always have to be on Disney films. We saw prequel trailers being on films that weren't 20th Century Fox films, for example. Now, given the way episode 1 was on A Bug's Life and episode 2 was on Monsters, Inc. and episode 3 was on The Incredibles, how about a June trailer on Pixar's Inside Out? Okay, maybe it's a bit cutesy trying to tie it all together like that, but maybe? Which leaves a fuller trailer probably sometime in October of 2015. Likely it will be released online to great fanfare and with some other movie in October. I don't have the October releases in front of me now to make a call on that. But I guess, hey, by October 15, it's all over, bar the shouting. I don't think any of us will be caring what film it's attached to. We're in countdown mode at that time. Anyway, hope that gave you some food for thought. Kate, great question. Your timeline might work if Disney is going to do things differently and stretch things out a bit longer. Or if they stick to a more prequel-ish kind of timeline, it may be like I've just outlined here. And as I mentioned earlier, we'll hear more from Kate later in the show. Now, if, like Sarah and Kate, you have any thoughts on things that get said on the show, or anything to do with Star Wars or Doctor Who at all, please get in touch. Twitter, Facebook, email, even send me an MP3. I'd love that, and we might just use it. Details on how to get in touch are at the end of the show. Okay, now, with the intro out of the way, what have we got in store this week? Well, we'll have my top 5 stories of the week. We'll look at Star Wars Rebels and why it might be worth your time. Lex will be looking at last week's awesome Doctor Who episode, Listen. I'll be taking a look at this week's Doctor Who episode, Time Heist. And finally, Kate will be reviewing Pest Control, a Doctor Who audio read by the 10th Doctor himself, David Tennant. That's a real lot of content, so without any further ado, let's get into it. Okay, first up, Star Wars Episode 7. There are possible spoilers ahead if you're very sensitive to being spoiled, but I guess to most of us it's just fun speculation that's not definitive at all, and not really spoilerish, but I just need to say it now. Turn off, turn off, turn off if you are very spoiler-phobic. Okay, Adam Driver. An image of Adam Driver popped up on the internet this past week, on set wearing... Well, everyone said it was an X-Wing outfit, but it wasn't quite an X-Wing outfit. I mean, the white vest that goes with it was way bigger than the vests in the classic trilogy. But I guess the helmet was similar, and the jumpsuit was, you know, kind of similar. It was actually kind of hard to tell whether it was an orangey or a reddy sort of colour. I know some of the A-Wing pilots, for example, in Star Wars wore reddish jumpsuits. And to be honest, the boots didn't look right, although... That's not so unusual. He might not have been showing his boots in the scenes he was being filmed in. I seem to recall Peter Cushing as Grand Moff Tarkin back in A New Hope. Whenever he didn't have to be showing his long Imperial boots in shot, I think he got around the set in, you know, really comfortable shoes or possibly even slippers or something as the story went. So the fact that Adam Driver's not really wearing traditional X-Wing style boots doesn't really mean much. But, of course, cue speculation. Does this mean Adam Driver is now playing a good guy? I mean, if he's getting around in this rebel-like X-Wing type outfit, you know, does that mean he's a good guy? People have been assuming he's a bad guy all along, and I mean, there's rumours out there right now that he possibly comes from the line of Count Dooku and is going around the universe knocking off other Force-sensitive people. So maybe he's pretending to be a good guy to get near someone he wants to bump off. Maybe Daisy Ridley? Who knows? Anyway, another website suggests that it could be just that the new pilots have gone rogue. So he might have been a good guy and has all the X-Wing gear, but now he's gone rogue and now he's a bad guy. Or maybe the bad guys have got some defunct X-Wing ships to turn them back on the Rebel Alliance. And I guess while that sounds plausible on some levels, why would they use the same pilot outfits? I mean, if they're Imperial pilots, why wouldn't they just wear their traditional Imperial outfits even if they were now flying X-Wings? So... Like a lot of rumours, you know, you can poke holes in it. But at the end of the day, some of these rumours we talk about this far out from the movie might just come true as well. What else? Oh yeah, this was a fun one. James Bond, Stormtrooper. The news broke this week that the current James Bond, Daniel Craig, has allegedly shot a 2-day cameo on Star Wars Episode 7 in a Stormtrooper costume. And of course... If that's true, that's awesome. I'm sure people will be watching the film and wondering, is that Daniel Craig? Hey, is that James Bond over there? We'll never know, I guess, unless J.J. Abrams or someone on the commentary says, oh, that Stormtrooper, you know, second from the right is actually Daniel Craig. I think that would be fun to know. This is the kind of cameo I like. It's someone who is not going to take us out of the action or the reality of the scenes by us going, oh, that's James Bond in Star Wars. But it's cool to know sometimes that someone might be behind a mask or behind a helmet who we might know like that. Also, an actor and friend of J.J. Abrams called Greg Grunberg he might actually be better known to some of you genre fans out there as Matt Parker on Heroes. He also tweeted that he'll be in the film in some capacity, although he wouldn't divulge what the role would be. So I don't know whether we'll see him with his own face, or whether he'll be behind a Stormtrooper helmet as well, like Daniel Craig was, or maybe behind a mask. Who knows? And the other cool bit of Star Wars information this week from the set of Episode 7 was, if you recall recently, Zack Snyder, who's making his Batman and Superman film, he put out a picture on Twitter of a Stormtrooper being arrested by some of Gotham's finest and being bundled into a police car. Well, J.J. Abrams has hit back, and we get a glimpse in a video he posted online of the Millennium Falcon. The Millennium Falcon in close-up. At the very start of the video, I think we can see some grass and stuff in the background, so it might be that half Millennium Falcon that they've currently got on set out there at those old bunkers, those old missile bunkers that I spoke about on Episode 2. And we sort of track along the Millennium Falcon, and it's really good for detail. You can sort of see all the pipes and all the greeblies that they've put on the Millennium Falcon model. Looks really good. Some nice weathering going on as well. And as it goes along, we've got Star Wars music, but then suddenly the Star Wars music turns into Batman music, and finally we focus in on a greebly stuck to the Millennium Falcon, and it's the Batmobile. And I thought, that's pretty nice. That's cute. So it looks like Zack Snyder and JJ might go back and forth promoting their movies. Of course it's a marketing exercise to be doing this, but in a really fun way that I think gets fans quite excited. I was certainly excited to see the Millennium Falcon like that. Also, just quickly, speaking of the Millennium Falcon, that half Millennium Falcon out on set has been photographed from ground level at this point, and we see that the familiar circular dish that used to be on top of the Millennium Falcon, and which got knocked off in Return of the Jedi. If you remember, Lando and Nian-Num were flying through the superstructure of the second Death Star, and they knocked the radar dish off the top of the Falcon. Well, the new radar dish is now rectangular, it seems. It looks like Han Solo has kitted it out with maybe a better radar dish on top of the ship. I'm certainly no expert on what shape radar dishes are best for the YT-1300 light freighters, but whatever, it now has a new radar dish. On to Doctor Who news, and following on from last episode, it does look like Jenna Coleman will make it to Christmas. When Peter Capaldi was asked last month about rumours that Jenna Coleman was set to leave Doctor Who at Christmas, his response was, "Well, I'm not looking for a new assistant. I don't know where these rumours have started. I've read she might be leaving at Christmas, but I don't even know if she'll get to Christmas." So that was a pretty enigmatic sort of response, but confirmation came recently from the BBC, along with some other interesting casting news, that yes, Jenna's in it, and also Shaun of the Dead's Nick Frost will also co-star, along with Faye Marseille, who can currently be seen in the drama series Glue, in addition to a former Coronation Street actress Natalie Gummede, and also Michael Troughton, the son of the second Doctor, Patrick Troughton. I mean, this throws up all sorts of questions for me now. Like, obviously, it's good to hear Jenna is in the Christmas episode. I think I mentioned last episode of this show that with it being Christmas, maybe she'll walk off happily into the sunset in the snow, maybe with Danny Pink, and all that'll be great. Or maybe she's going to get bumped off. But also, to hear Nick Frost is in this, that's great. We've obviously had his writing partner and acting partner, Simon Pegg, in an earlier episode of Doctor Who back in the Eccleston era. So now we're going to have those two guys having appeared in Doctor Who. That's great. But Michael Troughton, I mean, that's just awesome. I mean, we've seen his brother, David Troughton, in the 2009 episode Midnight. He wasn't playing, a copy of the second Doctor or trying to impersonate him or anything like that. But every time I hear a casting sort of announcement like this, I wonder, gosh, could it be a second Doctor flashback? You know, might he put on a wig and maybe impersonate his dad, you know, in some way? I know some people don't like that sort of thing, but I think that could be pretty cool. Anyway, we don't have a lot of information on the Christmas special yet, but Jenna's in it, Nick Frost is in it, these other two actresses are in it, and also Michael Troughton. Sticking with Doctor Who, the show is set to get its latest regular time slot ever, with the BBC indicating that from Saturday, the 27th of September, the show could air as late as 8:30, which would mean an end time of 9:15, which is a quarter of an hour past what they call in the UK the watershed, and much later than many of the younger fans might be needing or wanting with regard to how it ties into their own bedtimes. Even last year's 50th anniversary special and Peter Capaldi's debut episode, they both began at 7:50pm and thus only aired until 9:10pm, despite their extended running times. So now we're going to see episodes go longer, even at the regular 45-minute sort of length. Basically, the reason for this later time slot is the BBC will be showing Strictly Come Dancing and are sort of pinning their hopes that this double bill of Strictly followed by Doctor Who will help them win the ratings battle on Saturday nights against ITV, who are currently airing their talent show The X Factor in an 8pm to 9:20pm slot. Now, whether a chunk of Doctor Who's audience, which is young children and their parents, will agree with this remains to be seen, but I guess they can always go back and watch things on BBC iPlayer. It will affect the ratings if they're not watching the show live in terms of the initial overnight ratings, but in terms of consolidated ratings, those BBC iPlayer ratings do still count. So it will be very interesting to see what this does to Doctor Who's rating figures. If I can just say, the overnight figures have steadily come down in all the episodes we've seen this season so far, and they may come down even further if the show does get pushed out to this later time, at least in terms of that initial overnight rating. Back to Star Wars, and previously unseen sketches of costumes designed for the first three Star Wars films are about to pop up in a new book called Star Wars Costumes, The Original Trilogy. This is going to have more than 200 costume photographs, sketches, and behind-the-scenes photos and notes after the author, Brandon Allinger, was given the go-ahead to delve into the Lucasfilm vaults. I mean, this book sounds fantastic, I guess, for Star Wars fans in general, but particularly Star Wars fans who are into costumes. This is really cool stuff. Brandon is the chief operations officer of the LA branch of the Prop Store of London, who is a major player in the movie props and costumes industry in terms of selling them on to fans. I've bought a few things from the Prop Store before. I have Mel Gibson's, well, one of his dueling swords from Hamlet. If you remember Mel Gibson's Hamlet, at the end he has several fights using different swords, and at one point he dual wields these little daggers. I have one of those daggers. I bought that from the prop store. I also have, from the movie Alexander, one of Alexander's generals, Ptolemy, I have his helmet from that movie, which I bought from Prop Store London. So I'm very familiar with this place. And, you know, they've given Brandon Allinger some access to the Lucasfilm vaults, and he's written up this book. I'm sure it's going to be really great. Now, the publishers are Titan, and they've described the book, which is coming out in October, as an extremely rare and exciting opportunity to delve into the Lucasfilm vaults, revealing previously unseen sketches, stories, and much more. And a spokesperson said it combines all new photography with original artwork, exclusive behind-the-scenes images, new research, and new interviews with the costume designers, stitchers, and dressers. So it does look like they're going to talk to a lot of people from behind the scenes that we might not have heard much from before. And that's really cool. Check it out. Finally, another Star Wars rumour, but it's not an Episode 7 rumour, so I didn't speak about it in the Episode 7 section earlier. This is an Obi-Wan movie possibly going into production. And I've got to say, was there ever any doubt about this? I mean, people seem to be all confused and like, oh, this is new. But, you know, when there were rumours of films coming out, these are the standalone Star Wars films featuring young Han Solo, Boba Fett, and Yoda, I thought, well, young Han Solo, that works. Boba Fett, that's very cool. But Yoda? Like, I know a lot of people like Yoda, but I think a Yoda movie would suck. He moves too slow, he speaks too funny. He's not a leading man. I don't think Yoda, as cool as he is, and yes, I know once in a while he can jump around and, you know, fight with his lightsaber and stuff, but generally he's slow-moving, thoughtful. He's not someone who can carry a film. He's someone who's a great character in a film, but he can't carry a film. I thought it was just ridiculous that people were ever entertaining the idea that there would be a Yoda film. And if there is a Yoda film, I will be very, very surprised if it's any good. Obi-Wan, meanwhile, is popular. Ewan McGregor has always wanted to do another film or get involved with Obi-Wan Kenobi again. He's a massive Star Wars geek as well. He's charismatic. Well, both Ewan and Obi-Wan are charismatic. They're one and the same. He's a great leading man. And an Obi-Wan film would fill in a period of time that people are genuinely interested in. We saw Obi-Wan drop the twins off at the end of Episode 3. well, why don't we see Obi-Wan doing some missions, you know, between episode 3 and 4? I think this is awesome. I think this would be tremendous. I don't think Obi-Wan stayed all the time on Tatooine. He obviously knew about Mos Eisley Spaceport. I think he was probably a regular traveller over there, hiring passage to other places and, you know, getting around the universe and having adventures from time to time for whatever reason. And if that can be shown in a film, fantastic. You'll have Obi-Wan, you know, almost undercover, going up against the Empire, probably maybe finding other Jedi or chasing down rumours of other Jedi in the universe. I think it's just fantastic. Again, it's a no-brainer that there would be an Obi-Wan film. To think that it's weird or, you know, to only be thinking about the possibility now is just really odd. I think an Obi-Wan film joining young Han Solo and Boba Fett will be excellent, excellent standalone Star Wars films. Now, before this episode turns into a bit of a Doctor Who love fest later on, and don't worry, Star Wars fans, with Star Wars Rebels and new Star Wars films in the year ahead, it's not always going to be this one-sided on the show. I thought I'd roll back the clock to a piece I did a month or so ago on my old podcast called The Comic Book Show. And in this particular episode, I looked at Star Wars Rebels in a sort of a preview way and talked about why I was excited about it, particularly as an original trilogy fan, pushing 40 years old, who thought the Clone Wars TV series was, well, a bit childish. And don't worry, I also addressed that in more detail in this piece as well. I'm not quite the Clone Wars hater you might assume from that comment. So, without any further ado, let's join me a couple of minutes into the piece, after I'd got the opening credits and the introduction out of the way. What is Star Wars Rebels? Well, it's the new Star Wars CGI television series that's coming to TV in early October. It's set, they say, about 14 years after Star Wars Episode 3, that was Revenge of the Sith, and it's set about 5 years before Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope. So it's that interesting time period where the Galactic Empire has certainly ramped up, it's in power, and it's starting to secure its grip in the more regional areas, I guess you could say, of the galaxy. It's already secured it in the center of the galaxy, and it's just reaching out, you know, as big totalitarian regimes do, grabbing everything it can. And in the process of doing that, of course, it's still hunting down the last of the Jedi Knights, while in the background to that, there's a fledgling rebellion starting against the Empire, a rebellion that was in full swing by the time we got to Episode 4, but here it's still in its early days, it's still a bit in the background. So, does that sound exciting? I hope it does, because it's very, very, very exciting to me. And why is that? Well, I guess the first thing is the setting. I am an older Star Wars fan. I'm pushing 40, so Empire Strikes Back was the first Star Wars film I saw at the cinema, and I was really, really into Star Wars by the time Return of the Jedi came out in 83, so I come steeped in that original trilogy era. I love that time period. I love the characters in those movies. You know, they say it's whatever you grow up with, whether it's Star Wars or Star Trek or Doctor Who, whatever your first sort of taste of those IPs is, tends to be what sticks with you. So here we have something that's very, very close in tone and look and feel and stories to that original trilogy that I'm in love with. Now, the visual style of Star Wars Rebels is also heavily inspired by the concept art by Ralph McQuarrie. Now, if you're a Star Wars fan, Ralph McQuarrie needs no introduction, but if you're not too sure who he is, he drew and painted an awful lot of material, stuff that was just in George Lucas's head at one time, and George would explain it to Ralph. And Ralph would come up with these grand designs, some of which made it onto the screen with very little alteration, some of which were changed quite a bit. But he did such a body of work on Star Wars that you can flip through hundreds of paintings and drawings from him. You can even buy action figures and other collectibles now based on these conceptual drawings he did. You know, characters and armor and weapons we never even saw on screen. They've moved into a very elevated and revered position in Star Wars fandom. You know, Ralph McQuarrie, he's unfortunately passed away now. He passed away a few years ago. He is just a true legend. And so, you know, you can probably hear my interest and passion and excitement when I talk about Ralph, and the visual style of Rebels is heavily inspired by his work. So that's extremely exciting to me. Now, on top of that, what we've seen so far doesn't seem to be afraid of being a little more adult. Now, the Clone Wars CGI series, which was put together by a number of people who are also responsible for this new Rebels series, seemed to have learned some lessons. I mean, I tuned out from the Clone Wars CGI series in season 3 somewhere, and I'm told it got a lot better in 4, 5, and 6, seasons 4, 5, and 6, that is, but I never went back to it. I was told it got a bit more adult, but the horse had bolted. I needed to be seeing that from the get-go, and I think Rebels is actually going to start off being that little bit more adult, that little bit darker. I mean, at the end of the day, it still is a CGI series for kids that adults can appreciate. So don't get the wrong idea from what I'm saying, that it's suddenly going to be some adult sort of thing. But it will be different to the Clone Wars. So if you were put off the Clone Wars in a similar way to myself, because it was a bit too kiddie, and you never came back for the more adult episodes that people talk about in later seasons, then maybe this is something you can jump on like me from the early seasons and get involved. Also, another thing I'm really jazzed about, and we haven't even got to, you know, storylines or the main cast yet, is the recurring cast. Now, because this is set in that pre-episode 4 period, you can have people in it like Obi-Wan Kenobi, you can have C-3PO and R2-D2, you can have Lando Calrissian, and you know what, all four of those characters will be in Star Wars Rebels. Now, they won't be a week-to-week character, they don't want to overshadow the new characters we're being introduced to and the storyline we're being introduced to, but you will see Lando, you will see Obi-Wan, you will see the two droids, they'll be in Rebels. That's awesome, you know, I am so excited about that. And then we move on to the characters, the main characters in Star Wars Rebels. Basically, it's a crew. There's a ship called the Ghost, and we have the crew of the Ghost getting around the universe, doing their thing. And, you know, in the previews I've seen and in some of the stuff I've read, you know, maybe this feels a little Firefly. I don't want to oversell that Firefly angle too much, because this is obviously Star Wars. It's obviously got its own agenda. But there is a crew on a ship, and they're having capers, and it's not just a two-man crew like on the Millennium Falcon with Han and Chewie. Here we have Hera Syndulla. She's a Twi'lek female who owns and pilots the Ghost. We've got C-110P, or I should say C-1-10P, which when you write that out actually looks like the word chop, and he has the nickname Chopper, and that's Hera's astromech. We've got Kanan Jarrus. He's a renegade Jedi who has survived Order 66. I believe in the first of the new novels that are coming out to tie into Star Wars, the first of the new canon novels, we learn that Kanan after Order 66 was a very, I hope I'm doing this justice, but a sort of a drunken Han Solo type. So if you can imagine a Jedi Knight who's turned into a drunken Han Solo type, he's apparently like that in the novel. By the time the Rebels TV show starts, he's cleaned up his act, he's joined the crew of the Ghost and so on, he's a little different, but he has an interesting sort of background. And I must confess, at this point, when I first saw one of the trailers for Star Wars Rebels, it ended with the Kanan character standing up on some boxes or something in front of some Imperial troops, and he clicks together a lightsaber and ignites it, and everyone's taken aback, ooh, it's a Jedi, and I was kind of at the time thinking, oh, do we have to have another Jedi, you know? This is a period where Jedi are meant to be fairly rare, almost to the point of myth. They've been hunted down and so on. I really would have liked to have seen a story that was Jedi-free, but I guess they've got to include the Jedi for marketing reasons, and I guess there's a lot of people out there who like Jedi. I'd be quite happy if this crew were all non-Jedi, just regular people doing their thing, but they've slipped in Kanan Jarrus, and he is a Jedi. And you know what? The more I sort of see him and the more I hear him, he's voiced by Freddie Prinze Jr., for those of you who know Freddie Prinze Jr., I'm warming to him, you know, and it's not the kind of recoil I initially had from the fact it was a Jedi character. So that's okay. Then we have Ezra Bridger. He's a 14-year-old con artist and thief and pickpocket. And in fact, in the first 7 minutes of footage from the first episode of Rebels, which has been released online, and I'll give you the address for that later if you'd like it, he comes across as almost like Aladdin. And with the Disney connection now to Star Wars, I think a lot of people are making that connection. I hope that sort of look and feel doesn't continue, but just the way he gets around and some of the things he does in that 7 minutes, yeah, very Aladdin. And I've got to say, and I've said this to other people, I might have tweeted about it as well, when you have kids or younger people in a TV show, it's always something I'm a little dubious about. I mean, even when I was a kid myself, I never liked to see kids in my entertainment. I love the Star Wars films because, you know, Luke was already pushing 20 years old, so was Leia, Han Solo was much older, Obi-Wan Kenobi was older again. When I watched a movie like Star Wars, I liked it because it was full of adults doing adult things. And when there'd be cartoons like Battle of the Planets with Keop or Mask, there was a young character in the Mask cartoon series, and any cartoon series that sort of had kids in it, because you could see the writers were thinking, oh, we'll put a kid in because kids can relate to kids. No. Even when I was a kid, I used to think, I don't need a kid to be in this to relate to it. I would actually consciously have that thought because the kids were always never as good or interesting as the adults. They never could do the same things the adults could do. They just weren't interesting to me. I think, I'm a kid. I know what it's like to be a kid because I'm already a kid. I want to see adults doing cool stuff. So I recoil a bit from the Ezra Bridger character as well, but again, after seeing some footage of him and reading a bit more about him, I'm sort of warming to him, like I'm warming to Kanan as well. Yeah, an interesting one there. Then there's a character called Zeb Aurelius. He's a Lasat, and he's basically based on Ralph McQuarrie's original conceptual work for Chewbacca. Now, that's a really interesting kind of thing. If you've ever seen Ralph's drawings and it's like, oh, Chewbacca could have looked like this, it's a much meaner-looking, scarier-looking kind of character. And you often think, oh, gosh, I'm glad Chewbacca didn't look like that. He would have looked a bit out of place. But here, where they've reused that sort of artwork, Zeb kind of works. And he's voiced by Steve Blum, who's a very popular voiceover artist out there. If any of you play computer games particularly, you'll know that name straight away. And yeah, I'm quite interested in him. Some of the controversy around him at the moment is in this 7 minutes of footage we've seen so far, when Ezra Bridger jumps in on a caper that the crew of the Ghost are up to and sort of steals some of the material that they're stealing from the Imperials. Zeb gets quite mad and says, I'm going to end that kid. And a lot of people are getting really uptight that this Zeb character is basically saying he would kill a child, or at least a younger person. I'm actually not too sure that he means he would really kill Ezra. I think people are getting the wrong end of the stick with that line from Zeb. I think in day-to-day life, people say things like, oh, I'm going to kill that guy. And they don't actually mean they're going to kill that guy. It just means they're so angry with him, they could kill that guy, you know, but they never would in a million years. I think it's more one of those kinds of lines, like, oh, I'm going to end that kid. You know, he might give him a stern talking to or slap him around a bit, but he's not going to kill him, I don't think so. Yeah, Zeb is an interesting character and getting a bit of interest from podcasts and blogs at the moment because of that line that we've seen. And then finally we have Sabine Wren. She's also young, like Ezra, and wears Mandalorian armor. In fact, I believe she is a Mandalorian. If you're not familiar with Mandalorians, think of Boba Fett. So a Boba Fett-style mask and some armor. And she's into weapons and combat and explosives. And apparently she's also a graffiti artist who gets around and tags on Imperial facilities. So that's an interesting kind of twist to that character. I was going to say modern twist, but we've certainly had graffiti artists and the like, well, forever really, but in the modern sense, you know, since the 70s and so on. So it's interesting that that's finally come in and become part of a character in Star Wars and part of her background. Now, I don't know, with her being similar in age to Ezra, whether her and Ezra will end up having some sort of romance. I hope not. It may end up being that way because they're the two perhaps most likely to have a romance, well, besides perhaps Kanan and Hera. And yeah, so look, all up, the things I'm liking about Star Wars Rebels are outweighing the things I'm on the fence about. I went into great detail about the things that are exciting me, and I hope you've got a feel for the things I'm not liking, particularly in the characters, you know, Ezra's age, the fact Kanan's a Jedi, and so on. But those things that I'm negative about still aren't pushing me away from giving Rebels a really good try. In fact, I think Rebels will have a better start than Clone Wars did, both in terms of the writing and the animation style. I mean, the very first Clone Wars series was a long time ago now, relatively speaking, in terms of technology. So animation has come along a long way since then. It has a different look, and obviously has a deliberately different look as well, with that Ralph McQuarrie sort of influence as well, which wasn't there as much in Clone Wars. And I say as much because I think there's a little bit of Ralph in everything Star Wars that's been made at some time. But here, it's just unashamedly Ralph McQuarrie. Not only that, but I think the production team, particularly Dave Filoni, who is a co-creator of this series and a co-producer of this series, will have learned a lot of lessons in general from his time on Clone Wars. And they'll be brought to bear from the very, very first episode of Star Wars Rebels. And one other thing, this might not be to everyone's taste, but I'll mention it here. I think Star Wars Rebels will have to end in a very dark sort of place, because none of these characters, well, apart from the recurring people like Lando and Obi-Wan and R2-D2 and so on, none of the regular characters here, Hera, Kanan, Ezra, Zeb, Sabine, none of them are in Episode 4 and beyond. Now, unless Disney and Lucasfilm are going to start to retcon them into future material, I've got a feeling that there might be a bit of a tragedy towards the end of this series. Maybe some of these characters will be bumped off, because they can be. I mean, there's no greater drama than bumping off characters, but often writers and producers can't do that because the characters have to be saved for some future story that's already been written. Here, these characters don't appear in the future stories, so I think they're fair game. You know, they'll obviously join the rebellion at some point, they'll obviously do missions against the Empire. That's dangerous work. And if Kanan gets killed, or Ezra gets killed, or Sabine gets killed, I think that will only heighten the drama. I don't think it'll happen in the first series, maybe not even the second or third series. But if they intend to do, you know, four or five series, given that this is set 5 years before A New Hope, I've got a feeling we might not see all of these characters alive at the end of it. And I like that. I think that's realistic. I think in situations like these characters would be in, to have them all alive at the end of 5 years after doing dozens and dozens of missions against, you know, the evil Galactic Empire, I think it would be highly unrealistic for them all to be alive. So, yeah, there's that element to it too. I'm digging that. Okay, I mentioned earlier, I'd mention where to find all these great Star Wars Rebels videos if you've not seen them. Very simply, go to youtube.com/StarWars, and they've even set up a handy dandy playlist of just the Rebels material, so you can dip in there and see small trailers, longer trailers, you can see the 7-minute clip from the first episode of Rebels, you can see interviews with the people behind the production, people who are writing, people who are doing the voices, you can also see profiles of some of the main characters, which are quite revealing, really cool stuff there. Yeah, look, if you're a Star Wars fan and you don't know much about Star Wars Rebels, hopefully this has given you a bit of information about it, hopefully it's, you know, whet your appetite to get more involved, particularly if it can come from someone like me who's been a bit anti and a bit cynical with the previous CGI series in the form of the Clone Wars. I mean, I'm going to go back in the December Christmas holidays this year and actually watch Clone Wars from start to finish, which will include seeing those 4, 5, and 6 series stories that I've not seen before. So I'm prepared to even give that a go. But in terms of Rebels, this new series starting, if someone like me can sit down and say, hey, this looks like it could be worthwhile, this looks like it could be worth your attention, then, you know, you might just consider that it is. Okay, thanks to me for that piece on Star Wars Rebels. I hope it gave at least some of you out there some new information, either about what the show is about or why it might be worth your while. Even if you're an older and, dare I say it, a bit of a cynical Star Wars fan when it comes to the new stuff, especially stuff that's aimed, at least in part, at kids, I think there's some really good reasons to be giving Star Wars Rebels a good try from the start. Everything I hear from people I respect greatly, some of whom have not only seen the introductory two-parter, but also another episode besides, suggests that their enthusiasm for it goes way beyond the almost expected, hey, there's new Star Wars, and if I'm a Star Wars fan, I should be supportive of it and say nice things. No, it goes beyond that. It really is, I think, a more genuine, hey, that was actually good, you know, that kind of vibe. But, as always, you should make up your own mind when it starts in October 3 on the Disney Channel. I think Disney XD is the channel, with a one-hour special called Star Wars Rebels Spark of Rebellion. And then as a regular series on Monday nights, starting October 13. You know, I really should look into whether that means in Australia we'll actually see the show first in the world, alongside New Zealand, as our Monday night is basically before everyone else's. Okay, and now to the first of two pieces this week from brand new Who Wars correspondents. As you know, I'm super keen to get new voices into Who Wars, not only to give you a break from my voice, but also to get new thoughts and new ideas into the show. And I'll have more on being a correspondent later in the show if you're interested in getting involved, particularly the Star Wars fans among you. But for now, sit back and relax as Lex takes you on a really wide-ranging 15 minutes of thoughts based on her viewing of Doctor Who. Listen.
Hey y'all, I'm Lex. I'm going to talk about the episode Listen. There was a huge build-up for the episode, in case you didn't notice. Twitter was inundated with a very large number of very scared people. And then when it was all over, there was this ghastly wide range of reactions towards it. So this, of course, all means that I have to talk about it for 10 minutes. The last time Doctor Who had an episode like Listen, at least I'm pretty sure it was last time, was The God Complex. For a while, The God Complex was about fear. Just like Listen, the Doctor was facing his own fear. The two episodes have really different stories, yeah. I mean, Listen is framed as a spooky ghost story, and The God Complex is all madhouse circusy with sad clowns, evil gorillas, and confounding mazes. But just the same, both contained really powerful messages about fear. The God Complex and Listen both involve bad dreams. One episode has them in hotel rooms, and the other has them hiding under the bed. From comparing the two, I've noticed something that really gets to the root of why we watch Doctor Who. The Doctor, fundamentally as a character, can never resist chasing after his fears. I think we all know that. It's like the basis of how every episode ever has started. And yeah, it's the same is true with us. We can't resist chasing after our fears. But as often as he may chase them, we are just as frequently left shielded when we most want to see the truth. And this really bothers people. What happened with Listen at the end of the episode, it really pissed people off, myself included. It really bothered me, for starters, how the Doctor told Clara and young Danny to turn away from the thing under the blanket. And the same thing in the God Complex. When the Doctor found his door, we were allowed, like, a glimpse, like, just a hint of what it could be, what his fear could be. We know it was a who, but we were restricted from any other knowledge about it. Once again, we were not allowed to see behind his fear. Everything true there, everything material about his fear is completely hidden from us. So yeah, people get upset. This is sly teasing. But I suppose I'm missing the point. And it's important to talk about it because a lot of people were upset with Listen. So, listen up. It was a good episode. It's like what our podmaster Rob said last week. How fear is okay. We're all more alike than we think. Clara has this great line in Listen. It goes really fast. I actually missed it the first time. She says, "People don't need to be scared by a big gray-haired stick insect. Shut up." Gray-haired stick insect. I like it. So, Matt Smith was a clumsy giraffe, and Peter Capaldi is a stick insect with gray hair. Very good. But so not true. Wrong, Clara. We definitely need to be scared by a big gray-haired stick insect. So, actually, now that I've brought Clara into the mix, I just want to say how I am so, so pleased with the way that Clara and Capaldi's pairing is working out. I think Clara is absurdly pretty, almost too pretty. And I know it's kind of crude to say, but before, with Matt Smith as the Doctor, it was her doll face perfection. Her wide doll face perfection. And just her solid, grounded presence also. It really clashed with Matt's brazen oddities. They never quite meshed properly. But now I feel like that snagging on balance is kind of quelled with Capaldi. There's something about the rock-hard stability of Capaldi. I think the Scottish guy is a bit more straight-edged than Smith. Smith was better with companions like Amy and Rory, because they matched him in their wildness. They had no boundaries, and I think Capaldi is so different in that regard that Clara, by comparison, is suddenly the wild one. She's coming out in ways that we haven't seen before. She's more comfortable with Capaldi, I think. Her doll face and souffle perfection doesn't compete with Capaldi. And to be honest, I thought I saw that when she was with Matt Smith. The companions are supposed to make the Doctor look good, I think. And Clara is finally able to do that properly, I think, with Capaldi. I hope no one thinks I'm crazy for saying this. Like Rob said in his second episode, Clara can be a bit of an ass. She wasn't able to do that as successfully with Smith. successfully being an ass. I'm not really sure what I mean by that. Other than just, I think we'll start to see her start to unravel a bit more with Capaldi. She successfully is able to show some fiber of her being that wasn't allowed to be let out before. You know, she's been kept so neatly sewn together, and now she gets to unravel a bit and get messy. It's such a relief after all the quaint and snappy Scooby-Doo-ness she's been boxed into before. And, hey, also, Clara's new friend, Danny, what is the deal with the soldiers so far being named after colors? Journey Blue, Danny Pink, what? What is going on? Was this intentional? Danny and Journey kind of look alike, too. I was just wondering if that was intentional. Like, boy-girl colors, only they mixed up the sexes so as not to be too obvious. I mean, really, there has got to be some explanation behind that, and I want to know what it is. It's so ridiculous. I'm convinced I've missed something obvious, and I'm just being publicly stupid, which is just a grand way to make a first impression on a podcast, isn't it? Ugh. Anyways, back to the episode. I, for one, do not believe it was a child under that blanket. I was left very unsatisfied because I was so sure it was not a kid playing a joke. No way. I have to depend on what the viewers are shown for my sanity. You know, what I can call truth, what we are shown is what actually happened. And hey, what we were shown was not a kid. That thing was gliding and had superhuman speed. The most important part of this episode, listen, was showing that the Doctor has this unharnessed fear. He is just as afraid as anybody. This episode, we see it almost drive him mad. We're told that fear is a superpower, and that made me think, huh, well, just how super is the Doctor? He is a superhero in my eyes. And yeah, superheroes have superpowers. So what's his superpower? His brain? His screwdriver? Yeah, they definitely help. Or is it his fear? Being scared is a superpower. It was said a couple of different times in the episode, and it is so true. The power of fear makes us do the extraordinary, pushes us into extremes. Could it be that the Doctor is just more scared than anybody out there? It puts him more on our level. We're all more alike than we think. I think the writers try really hard to get that point across. So how are we supposed to see him? Is he a hero or is he just a guy? But the writers make it so hard to see him as just a guy when they keep hiding all of the big mysteries from us. We can't know what's real or what's not. How are we supposed to see him as anything else? And is anything real when we can't see the point in all the hooks that these episodes keep jabbing into us? What the heck does the doctor see behind the door in room number 11? What is under the blanket? Who wrote "listen" on the chalkboard? These hooks are real, and they're just never explained. So how is this supposed to help? How are the writers putting us in a direction that gives us the correct mindset of things? The doctor puts a "please do not disturb" sign on the door of his fear, and that's pretty funny because the writers are doing exactly that. They're putting a "do not disturb" sign on the actual cause of the doctor's fears. Critical parts to the story, this whole Doctor Who world, but anyways. So, fear. Yeah, sure, we can talk about it, but what causes it? No, we can't talk about that. Alright, I'm going in a circle now. I'm missing the point again. Listen was about fear, the sensation, not the scary monsters, not the material basis behind the fear. I should just take a deep breath. Take what I've been given and be happy with it, right? Stephen Moffat did a fantastic job with this episode. "I'm not a hero," the doctor says in The God Complex to Amy Pond. "I really am just a madman in a box." And it appears it's true once again. As Claire's interpretation shows, the doctor has caused this whole giant goose chase over nothing in Listen. The doctor is crazy. The original under-the-bed fear was caused by Clara. She was the one who planted it all in the first place. Not, as I mentioned before, something I believe, but isn't it interesting how two companions, Amy and Clara, have both had to go through the same process in these two episodes, denigrating the faith they have in the doctor to something that is not entirely, but largely false. And it's a funny message these writers are selling to fans of Doctor Who, isn't it? Let's degrade the doctor down to nothing but a supercharged fear man. Good idea! It's sort of like saying, now seriously, we're skewing things out of proportion here. He really isn't invincible, he's just a crazy man. But in the meantime, look at all these episodes. This one's great. He saved the planet there. Oh, and ooh, and that one he connected brains with a Dalek. Oh, and there was that time he rebooted the universe. I mean, hello? That's called being invincible. You know, like, what are they trying to make us believe? The point of the show is to give thrills, right? To stand in awe of the doctor says in The God Complex, "I was vain, and I wanted to be admired." Yes, Doctor, we want to admire. And I think it's especially true this strange message won't last because of all the effort writers are putting into hiding the many truths of the Doctor. The real explanations of the bed monster and what was in room 11. One just can't believe this denigrating message will really take us anywhere significant. They try too hard to make things, you know, amazing. So, as viewers, we exist to admire the Doctor. And they, the writers, will continue to hide some of the significant truths of this show from us. It's cheap, but a trade we have to agree on if we want to keep watching the show the way it is. Contradictory messages like this are really funny. It's so funny. So hypocritical of a show to sell a message like that. It's a joke. Good one, Moffat. Good one, Whithouse. Really amusing. Okay, so I love Doctor Who. I love how it makes me think. How it can offer reality checks, even if they never completely own up to them. I really do appreciate it. So I'm gonna leave off with this final question. Why did he make them all turn their back on the little blanket monster in Danny Pink's room? Was that just manipulation of conniving or lazy scriptwriters who did not want to create yet another Who monster? Or was it Moffat trying to make a point that, yeah, the Doctor is scared. Look, he's just a scared man. Because they could have actually made it so that they did uncover the mask of the blanket thing. You know, they could have done that. They could have come clean, been honest, and shown us a kid. They could have shown us a child, but they didn't. Moffat chose to let it remain as a mystery. People get angry. People feel gypped. I promise never to look, says little Danny. Fortunately, the writers do a lot of that for us. They don't let us look quite a lot. But it's okay, really. If you think about it, leaving the blanket a mystery led us to a better storyline, where we got to see a lot more of time and space because there were more questions. We got to see the doctor as a kid. Answers, my friends, are endings. Questions give us more adventures and longer episodes. And that's what we want, right? Yep. I thought so. So, hey, look at that. It's been 15 minutes. I lied. Sorry. And thanks, Rob, for introducing me to this podcast. Till next time.
Thanks, Lex. Some awesome points there. Comparisons to the God Complex and questioning at length what was under the blanket in Listen were not only interesting comments for me to hear in themselves, but also examples of why I've been so keen to get correspondence on the show. I mean, they're things I didn't touch on at all in my look back, my first look review of Listen last week. Fingers crossed, Lex will be back next week to talk about Time Heist, the episode that I'm about to give my first looks review of in just a moment. If you want to catch up with Lex on Twitter, you can find her at Lexaness. That's LexRNESS. Now it's time for our first look Doctor Who review of the episode. This week the episode was Time Heist. It aired earlier today in Australia in simulcast with the UK. And I've watched it twice now, as I like to do. The first time just watching and taking it all in. The second time scribbling down some notes as I watched it with my wife. Now, naturally, this is spoilerific. So if you've not seen the episode, please be aware that I won't hold anything back in the next little while. Please turn off if you don't want to be spoiled. Now, where to begin? Since this episode aired earlier today, I've been saying to people that to me, it was an example of good weekly Doctor Who. And what I mean by that is that it wasn't a series opener, and it wasn't introducing a new companion, and it wasn't a series finale. It was simply a weekly episode of the show, keeping everything moving forward. And on top of that, it was a good one. So many times during this episode, I was thinking to myself, why weren't the stories in Series 7 like this? So, yes, up front, I liked it. It wasn't revolutionary or even evolutionary. It wasn't like last week's out-of-the-box surprise package of Listen, but that's okay. Doctor Who across a series isn't meant to be that every week. In fact, if I can digress for a moment, I think there was a period during the Matt Smith era where the production team was promoting each episode as a mini-movie. You know, they're making sort of movie posters for it and all this, and actually saying, you know, it's like having a movie each week, which to me fundamentally failed to understand what Doctor Who should be about. Doctor Who shouldn't be trying to be a blockbuster movie on fast forward each week, because, you know, it just doesn't have the resources to pull that off, and it just ends up looking silly. That's a huge reason, I think, why Series 7 in particular was a real turkey. Matt Smith himself was great. I like the Matt Smith Doctor a lot. But everything around him wasn't great. You know, it's also the reason why Clara is 10 times better in this series, Series 8, than in the past. The stories are just better suiting the length of the show, the finances of the show, and I think just what many fans are looking for. And of course, there are some detractors out there. There are people who won't stop saying how much they miss Matt Smith and how they just don't get the Capaldi Doctor. And, you know, I'm betting that some of them are the same people who couldn't believe David Tennant was leaving Once Upon a Time and were saying, who's this new bloke? What's with that chin? And all the other abuse Matt Smith once copped. But now, a few years later, it's like he was the second coming for those fans. And we now have thin young men in tweed jackets and cute girls in fezzes at conventions all around the world. So, they'll come around eventually. Probably two or three series from now when Capaldi's on the way out. It's always the way. But I digress. I really digress. Having this good, solid, fun weekly episode of Doctor Who, which didn't try to outstretch itself, was great. I really liked Time Heist. Now, let me grab my notes and we'll scan through to see if there's anything I found particularly noteworthy to mention. Okay, the first thing I've scribbled down is the Doctor having to pick up Clara, and once again, I know I might sound like a broken record on this topic, I'm really not a fan of the way Clara's like, I want to have this normal life, and you've got to come and, you know, collect me every time we go on an adventure. It's like Clara doesn't understand the nature of time travel. She doesn't understand that she could have 100 adventures with the Doctor and then be returned to the same point in time. She doesn't have to keep having an adventure, then go back, and then get picked up again, and have an adventure, and go back, and get picked up again, and have an adventure, and get picked up. It's like, Clara, do you not get this time travel thing? Anyway, it did give us some funny scenes where she was saying she was going out and the Doctor threw out the line, "Why is your face coloured in?" Obviously referring to her makeup. And I've seen people on social media complain about this, like the way, you know, I think it was last episode, he referred to her face being very wide, and, you know, he's made other personal comments about her before, and some people are getting very offended on Clara's part about this. But it's there to sort of show how alien this Doctor is and how he just doesn't see Clara as a desirable object or a sexual object perhaps, or whatever. You know, these lines about where he just doesn't get that she's an attractive woman are saying a lot about his character. They're not just there to be cruel, you know. It's strange how some people perceive that. Anyway, moving on. I've jotted down here that the memory worms look budget, and I guess they did. I mean, some of the costuming in this episode was really good. Like the telepathic creature, I'm not sure if we even got a name for that. It looked, you know, passable. But the little memory worms, they look like something that could have come from the classic era of Doctor Who. They were that sort of rubbery and fake-looking and strange. Maybe that was deliberate. I don't know. But, yeah, that was interesting. I've then jotted down, running down corridors, exclamation mark. And although it's not probably the first time this Doctor and Clara have run about somewhere, in this episode there were a lot of corridors and a lot of running down corridors, very classic era kind of thing. And speaking of budgets, I guess the budget on this episode was pretty low because they were reusing the same corridor over and over, and to make it look different, they'd light it with different coloured lights to make it look like, oh, this character's in the red section and this character's in the blue section and all that, but it was really just the one corridor. I try not to think about those things when I watch episodes, but it's hard sometimes not to notice. So I think this episode probably saved a bit of money in some ways. Then I've jotted down, Clara looks good in a pantsuit. And it's true, the Clara costume in this episode was very different to the dresses she normally wears, and I think she looked really great in it. It was very practical for running down all those corridors, and I think it suited her. Just a random sort of, not a fashion comment, but just a character sort of comment, I guess, that she dressed quite differently to the Clara we typically have seen, and that's good. I like seeing this different sort of look on Clara. Then I've jotted down, Sai alternates between being super helpful and super distrustful. And I don't know whether that was meant to be some sort of malfunction in the chips that are in his head or quite what was going on, but he'd seem really friendly and useful at times, and then at other times just snap and be like very distrustful and weird. And that was a bit disconcerting at times. He, obviously, in the end, he came across as a really good character, really interesting character, quite a nice guy. But earlier on, particularly, he just seemed to be a bit all over the place with the way he was being written, and I don't think it really came across that it was meant to be because of the chips in his head or anything like that. So just something I noticed there. Also regarding Sai, I've written down problem. To me, this reminded me so much of Max Headroom. If some of you out there are saying, Max who? Go and look up Max Headroom. Try and find some videos of Max Headroom. It's an 80s TV character, and he was an electronic sort of character. He'd often get stuck in what he was saying, and just the way Sai was saying problem reminded me very much of Max Headroom. I think it might have reminded some of you out there of that too. Sabra, my wife, piped up at one point and said, oh, she's like Rogue from X-Men, she can't be touched. And I thought, oh, yeah, you know, obviously for different reasons, but that was kind of interesting. Exit strategy, I've written down here. The way they disappeared, I had suspicions, and then I've written Bad Wolf. And yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. The whole exit strategy, those little capsules that they took out of the box, and it looked like they were ways to suicide if they got caught on the mission, and so on. Yeah, just the way when I think Sabra was the first to activate one, just the effect. It didn't look like she was being ripped apart or dissolving. It did look like she was beaming up. It was almost a Star Trek-like effect that she was beaming up. And from that moment, I thought, oh, this is like in Bad Wolf, where, you know, if you remember Bad Wolf, they got hit with what looked like a laser beam. Rose got hit with it, and she disappeared, and we thought she'd been, you know, destroyed, blown up. but she'd just been transmatted, you know, I guess you could say. And here, almost from the start, I thought, oh, the exit strategy is to be transmatted somewhere else. So it didn't quite work on me like it was supposed to, obviously, because Sabra and Sai both have to, you know, quotation marks, commit suicide. And to me, right from the start, I could sort of tell that they weren't, but that's okay, you know, only a minor thing. Ooh, next point's an interesting one. I jotted down this, I think it's a quote from Sai, and my writing is terrible, and I've probably not captured every word, but you'll know the bit I mean. And it says, Clara, when your life flashes in front of you, you see people you love and who miss you, and I see no one. This is Sai, just before he's about to, quotation marks again, commit suicide. And is this another reference to Clara dying? We've had a few in the series so far, and now we have someone who's about to commit suicide, you know, shouting out to Clara about what it's like. And, you know, is that a subtle reference to all these other references about Clara dying? Is Clara going to die at the end of the series? Well, in the Christmas episode, at least. I don't know. I just picked up on that. Not long after that, I jotted down time travel, can't use the TARDIS, storm, I twigged. And, yeah, that's probably the point where I twig that the heist is being set up by someone in the future. The TARDIS couldn't travel there. I started to twig that I think the Doctor's behind this. I think the Doctor is, you know, the player. And, of course, the Doctor really was the person playing them in this. So maybe like the exit strategy stuff, I twigged onto this a little earlier than perhaps I should have. Perhaps if I was going to enjoy the episode more, I really shouldn't have twigged. But, unfortunately, I did. Only a few random quotes now to go. I wrote, the Doctor on his knees reminds me of Pyramids of Mars. And that's true, when that telepathic creature started scanning the Doctor's brain and the Doctor fell to his knees and was struggling to speak. Reminded me of a scene very much in Pyramids of Mars. Fans of the classic era will probably know the one I mean. And then there was a great quote about the Doctor's new look. He says something along the lines of, I was hoping for minimalism, I got magician. And I think that ties back in a real life way to, I think I've even seen quotes about the Doctor or Peter Capaldi himself saying he wanted the costume to be fairly simple, fairly minimal. Conversely, I've seen other people, you know, when it first came out and he was showing the red insides of his jacket with the way he'd put his hands in his pockets or whatever. I thought that was a very Pertwee kind of thing to do, but I did see a lot of people say, oh, that makes him look like a magician. So it's almost like the writer has picked up on that, you know, Capaldi's thoughts about minimalism in the costume and, you know, maybe even fan comments about it looking like a magician's costume. And it was just a really nice line. I've jotted down, the Doctor signals in a phone-like way to Sai at the end of the episode when they're dropping him off after they've all had some Chinese food and the Doctor starts dropping them off. So has the Doctor given Sai his number? I got the feeling that Sai and Sabra might be interesting allies for the Doctor in times ahead. And he didn't signal anything similar to Sabra. Maybe he didn't have to. Maybe that would be overkill. But clearly, by signaling phone to Sai as he left, Sai's got his number. Why would he do that? Maybe it won't even be this season when Sai comes back to adventure with the Doctor. But is it a possibility for the future? Maybe it is. I'd like to think it is. I'd like to think that, you know, phone me kind of, you know, message actually meant something and it wasn't just for no reason. Last thing I scribbled down is rob a bank, beat that for a date. And I don't know, I got a funny feeling from this and it goes against what I was saying earlier in the episode about the Doctor not seeing Clara in a girlfriend type way. I mean, he's clearly said in the first episode of this series, I'm not your boyfriend. We've had all these episodes where he's saying, you know, stuff that clearly shows he's not looking at her in that sort of way. And yet, this line, all of a sudden, beat that for a date. It's almost like competition. He doesn't know about Danny Pink. He hasn't spoken to Danny Pink. But he obviously sees there's some competition here because he's always dropping Clara off to go on these dates and so on. And he's, you know, quite proud here that he just took Clara off to rob a bank, you know, the hardest bank to break into in the universe. You know, beat that for a date, whoever, you know, Clara's date is. That was interesting. That made me think, is the Doctor sort of changing in this sort of attitude, or was it just a throwaway line? I don't know. Anyway, all up, I did enjoy this episode. Again, it's not revolutionary, evolutionary, it's not, you know, jump out of your seat, excitement and all of that. Although it was very fast-paced, it still wasn't, you know, something done at breakneck speed that you couldn't really understand. it was just a good, solid, fun episode of Doctor Who. I find it very hard to criticise, but nor was it something like a season opener or a season finale or anything like that. Just a great, normal episode. What did you think? Did you think similar to me? Or did you like it? Did you not like it? You can get in touch with me in a number of ways. Facebook, Twitter, email, send me an MP3, whatever you like. The details for all of that are at the end of the show. Phew, there's been a lot in this episode, but it's not over yet. Now we have Kate to talk to us about one of the BBC Doctor Who audios, Pest Control. Kate?
Okay, thank you, Rob. Hi, everyone. I'm Kate, aka @Kamadu on Twitter. Every other week, I'll be bringing you a review of a Star Wars or Doctor Who audiobook. I'll be starting with the Doctor Who New Series Adventures, which is a series of original audiobooks that was produced from May 2008 to December 2012. The first book in this series is Pest Control, and that's the one I'll be reviewing today. Pest Control was written by Peter Angelides and is read by David Tennant. So basically, it's already an automatic 10 out of 10 for me. The cover art is really interesting. It's got 10 in the foreground with Donna Noble behind him, a large green beetle, and a bizarre centaur-looking thing with a crossbow and arrow. This one takes place on the planet Recension during the Second Great and Bountiful Human Empire, so it's in the future, about 42nd century. It features the 10th Doctor, Donna Noble, various human colonists fighting against the centaur species, which is called the Aquabi, the Serfians, which are those giant green beetle things, and then there's also a giant robot, because this is Doctor Who, and of course there's got to be a giant robot. The basic premise of this story is that the TARDIS lands on this planet in the middle of a war between the human colonists and the centaur race called the Aquabi, and Donna and the Doctor get split up. Donna goes with the humans, and the Doctor gets put in an Aquabi prison, and the Serfians, those giant green bug things, they actually use the bodies of both of these species as hosts, and so what happens is the eggs kind of hatch from within the person, and it's really gross. But then the giant robot, he comes, and he's been programmed to eliminate all the Serfians. So there's a few more surprises, but I won't give everything away. So what did I like about this audiobook? I really liked David Tennant, of course. We all know that he's very talented and entertaining. He does a lot of different voices in this and a variety of accents, and he even does a really good Donna Noble. There's also excellent sound effects and music, and the writer did a really good job writing Donna as her delightful, sassy self. There's also Star Trek references, so if you're a Trekkie, you might like that. Donna is referred to as Captain Kirk, and the Doctor is referred to as Dr. McCoy, so that was really cute. The Doctor rides a motorbike in this one, and a centaur, so that was cool. There's some interesting themes that I liked in this about war and peace, who's your enemy, and then also a theme about it's what's on the inside that really matters. So what didn't I like about this audiobook? Well, while the war setting can be interesting, I thought that it was rather bleak, and it wasn't my favorite setting. And then also, it tended to get a little bit confusing to determine just who the bad guys were, because you have the main conflict, you have the bugs, and then you have the giant robot. But overall, I really liked it, and I felt like it was an episode that you would see on TV. So, I give this one 8 sonic screwdrivers out of 10. If you're a Doctor Who fan, it's definitely worth 2.5 hours of your time. Well, that's going to do it for me this time. I'll see you again in 2 weeks when I review the next book in the series, The Forever Trap. Until then, allons-y, and may the Force be with you. Back to you, Rob.
Thanks for that, Kate. If you want to catch up with Kate on Twitter, as she mentioned at the start of her piece, she's at Kamidu. That's Kamidu. You know, I remember Pest Control myself. I have the CD here on my shelf, although it's been ages since I listened to it. I do remember, though, like Kate was saying, that Who's Who got a bit confusing at times. On the whole, I seem to recall it's not a bad audio, but there are better to come in the BBC range. And hopefully we'll be hearing more about that range from Kate in the weeks ahead. So here we are at the end of the third Who Wars. I hope you liked the addition of our correspondence, especially as that was just the beginning of what I want to be doing in that area. I want to be bringing more on board as the weeks go by, and Star Wars fans, have no fear, there are some Star Wars correspondents coming. In fact, you may have already heard one of them already. Okay, if you'd like to be a correspondent, especially now that you've heard some on the show, please be in touch. I'm especially looking for people who want to tackle Star Wars-related material every week, or every 2 weeks, or every 4 weeks, some sort of regular schedule like that. The actual topics, up to you. Please get in touch with me the regular ways. Now, what's coming next week? Well, I'll be bringing you a review of John Jackson Miller's A New Dawn, so you can hear my thoughts on it before the Star Wars Rebels TV series begins. I'm sure there'll be more Star Wars Episode 7 rumours, and in Doctor Who, the new series will continue on, and you'll be hearing all about it alongside all the latest news right here. Be sure to send me questions or comments, details on how to, in the credits package I'm about to hit play on, including MP3 files. Please send me MP3 files, they work so well. If you'd like to hear your comment on the show in your own voice. Okay, everyone, that's a wrap. Good night, and talk to you next week.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.